From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The truth is that we see more military recruiters coming into our schools than college recruiters.
No child unrecruited. Military recruiting in high schools. We'll talk to students, recruiters, and a longtime anti-ROTC activist. The U.S. Army joins the video game industry. And finally, the former CIA director Robert Gates has become one. Michael Crow, the vice chair of a nonprofit venture capital arm of the CIA, becomes one. They are now college presidents. After September 11th, the CIA becomes a force on campus. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As many as 100 Israeli tanks and armored vehicles raided Nablus this morning as the army took over the West Bank town and the nearby Askar and Balata refugee camps. At least 35 Palestinians have been arrested. Earlier, Israeli military helicopters fired missiles on Gaza City, targeting a metal workshop, which was also hit on Monday. The large-scale incursion of Nablus was launched just 24 hours after Israeli troops raided the town of Tul Karm. Israel said Tul Karm and Nablus are being attacked because they have suspected links to Sunday's kibbutz raid, in which a Palestinian gunman killed five Israelis, including a mother and her two children. Meanwhile, Tuesday, Benjamin Netanyahu vowed the ejection of Yasser Arafat from the Palestinian territories would be his first order of business if he were elected prime minister. A group of British medical experts have warned that a war against Iraq could kill 500,000 people. The report predicted as many 260,000 would die in a three-month conflict and a further 200,000 would be at risk from famine and disease. A civil war in Iraq could add another 20,000 deaths. The report by Medical Action for Global Security assumed an attack on Iraq would begin with sustained airstrikes followed by an invasion of ground troops culminating in the overthrow of Baghdad. In the report's worst-case scenario, a nuclear attack on Iraq would leave nearly 4 million people dead. The medical experts conclude that the resulting death toll will be much higher than the 91 Gulf War, which killed around 200,000 Iraquis. Between 500,000 and 1 million Iraqis are believed to have died since the Gulf War officially ended because of U.S.-backed economic sanctions and bombing. The UN resolution demanding Iraq disarm includes a little-noted provision that could be an early trigger for war. The Associated Press is reporting that the resolution may require Iraq to stop its frequent firings on U.S. and British planes, enforcing no-fly zones over the country's northern and southern sectors. One sentence in the resolution says Iraq, quote, shall not take or threaten hostile acts against any personnel of any UN member state who are taking action to uphold any Security Council resolution. Some members of the Bush administration say this is relevant, but the view is not universally accepted, however, because the patrols have never been authorized by the UN Security Council. Richard Perle, a leading Pentagon advisor on Iraq, last night charged that Chief UN Arms Inspector Hans Blix is an unsuitable candidate and warned the inspection team would be outnumbered and outwitted by Iraqi officials. In an extensive interview with The Guardian of London, Perle, who advises War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz, also backed the assassination of Saddam Hussein. In addition, he charged Europe had lost its moral direction and accused Germany of unilateralism for taking an anti-war stance. The BBC is reporting that experts across the world believe Osama bin Laden is still alive. This comes after the Arabic television station Al Jazeera aired a recording of him yesterday praising the recent killings in Bali, Kuwait, and Yemen, as well as the takeover of a Moscow theater by Chechen rebels. For the 11th consecutive year, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly yesterday to end the four-decade U.S. trade embargo against Cuba. The final vote was 173-3. The United States, Israel, and the Marshall Islands voted against the measure. A group of South Africans have filed a lawsuit against 20 banks and major multinational companies for supporting apartheid. The group blames the companies for helping support a government that left some of them maimed, others raped and tortured. Companies and banks sued include Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, ExxonMobil, Ford, General Motors, IBM, Deutsche Bank, Daimler Chrysler, and British Petroleum. At least six Afghan students have died in the past few days during protests against poor university conditions and police mistreatment in Afghanistan. Around 2,000 students assembled yesterday outside the gates of Kabul University, refusing to attend lessons until their demands for improved accommodation and justice for those who died were met. The protests turned to chaos as riot police opened fire on the crowds. Meanwhile, in Iran, at least 3,000 students gathered yesterday at Tehran's university campus to protest the death sentence of a reformist academic, Hashem Agajari, who has been sentenced to die for questioning the clergy's right to rule. Protests and student strikes have also been reported in other provincial universities, including Isfahan, Tabriz, and Kerman. William Webster resigned yesterday as the head of a new governmental board to oversee the accounting profession. Webster, who once headed the FBI and the CIA, quit 1 week after Harvey Pitt stepped down as head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. The commission's chief accountant, Robert Herdman, who oversaw the selection of the accounting board, also quit last week. With Webster's announcement, both the board and the Securities and Exchange Commission, which selected the members of the accounting panel as supposed to oversee its work, are without leaders. Webster's selection had been sharply criticized after it was disclosed last month that he had headed the audit committee of U.S. Technologies, a nearly insolvent company that has been accused of fraud. Pitt knew of the accusations but never mentioned them to the SEC commissioners or the White House. The Federal Emergency, or rather the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, ignored or missed early cues that Enron Corporation might have manipulated wholesale electricity prices in California and Western markets. This according to a Senate report that has just been released. It concludes that the commission failed to protect U.S. consumers from alleged market abuses by Enron during the California power crisis of 2000 and 2001. A federal program to randomly check cars in a search for terrorists and illegal immigrants began yesterday in Michigan, home of the largest concentration of Arab Americans in the United States. Border Patrol agents at the random checkpoints will now ask passengers their citizenship and will have leeway to ask a host of follow-up questions. New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, Washington are among the northern border areas that already have similar programs in place. A much-delayed bill to create a new domestic security agency gained congressional support from Democrats yesterday and appears all but certain to become law. A key stumbling block in the bill's approval has been whether the administration can waive civil service agreements in hiring and firing employees who would work in the new department. That provision was approved. The bill would create a mammoth new cabinet department with roughly 170,000 employees drawn from 22 federal agencies. It represents the largest reorganization of the federal government since World War II. A Homeland Security Council would be established within the White House to coordinate domestic response to terrorist threats. The bill, however, apparently omits a proposal to establish an independent commission to investigate September 11th attacks. Also, in the wake of last week's election, Democrats are also expected to give way tomorrow and allow the confirmation of two appeals court nominees. And a group of Roman Catholic activists have launched a website naming U.S. clergy who've been found guilty or have been accused by the public of sexually abusing children. The Survivors First group compiled a database listing 573 priests alleged to be involved in pedophilia cases since 1996, using details from newspaper articles and sometimes court documents. The publication of suspected molesters' names came as bishops continue to discuss ways of tackling the crisis which has dogged the church in the United States. And last Friday, Democracy Now! Reported on an American nurse and a British professor who've been imprisoned in an Indonesian jail for more than 2 months. They were arrested on September 10th for violating their tourist visas, and they were attacked by the Indonesian military. The two women, Joylee Sadler and Leslie McCulloch, were in the Indonesian province of Aceh, providing health care to refugees and conducting research on military atrocities there. The Indonesian military has killed thousands of Indonesians in the gas-rich area where ExxonMobil operates. Indonesian authorities have said they want to make an example out of the two women. Despite the attention being brought to the case, the Indonesian government has still not set a trial date. Earlier this week, Sadler revealed she is HIV positive and her health is quickly deteriorating. Both women were beaten by the Indonesian military when they were arrested. For more information on this case, you can go to indonesianetwork.org. And the organization Indonesia Human Rights Network is encouraging people to fax the ambassador directly. You can do that through indonesianetwork.org. Rumors of War here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An article in the current issue of Mother Jones goes something like this. The principal of Mount Anthony Union High School in Bennington, Vermont, Sharon Shea Keneally, was shocked when she received a letter in May from military recruiters. The letter demanded a list of all her students, including names, addresses, and phone numbers. The school invites recruiters to participate in career days and job fairs, but like most school districts, it keeps student information strictly confidential. Sharon Shea Keneally said, "We don't give out a list of names of our kids to anybody, not to colleges, churches, employers, nobody." But when Shea Keneally insisted on an explanation, she was in for an even bigger surprise. The recruiters cited the No Child Left Behind Act, President Bush's sweeping new education law passed earlier this year. There, buried deep within the law's 670 pages, is a provision requiring public secondary schools to provide military recruiters not only with access to facilities, but also with contact information for every student, or face a cutoff of all federal aid. Well, today on Democracy Now!, we're going to have a roundtable discussion on the issue of military recruitment in high schools. We'll begin with the journalist who wrote the piece in Mother Jones, David Goodman, author of No Child Unrecruited. David, can you explain the No Child Left Behind Act?
Well, many people have heard of the No Child Left Behind Act because of the controversy it spawned relating to requirements that students will have to be tested every year, and this is what's grabbed the headlines. What almost nobody, including, I should point out in my interviews, nobody in the military or in the education sector was aware of was these three paragraphs that required the military to be given access, where in many cases they were never allowed before outside of, as you pointed out, these career days and job fairs. What has changed with this provision being included is that there are a number of school districts around the country For example, the entire city of San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, which bar military recruiters because of the military's policy of discriminating against gays and lesbians. Those districts, among others, will now be required to allow recruiters physical access to their high schools, but also they will be forced to give over this so-called directory information. Now, there is a catch, and that is that students can opt out of having their names provided to the military. However, opting out requires that they be notified in the first place that the directory information is being given. Probably a number of listeners may have received letters in the last few weeks from their schools, the high schools, letting them know that they can opt out. But these opt-out provisions are somewhat notorious in terms of how few people respond. As any school parent knows, they get a raft of letters and permissions, and this may be tucked in among them. Or in the rules that were just issued a few weeks ago, the Department of Defense and Education issued a FAQ, a Frequently Asked Questions, to school administrators and said that if they want, they can just tuck it into the list of school rules, you know, that it goes out at the beginning of the year, the 50-100-page list with all the dress codes and whatnot. And one sentence in there can simply say that parents who are concerned about this can send in a note and opt out. So the opt-out provision is something that very few people at the moment are even aware of, nor are they exercising it.
What are parents supposed to do? They write a note to the school, or the kid, him or herself, can just say on a piece of paper, do not send information on to the Pentagon?
That's right. I do not want my directory information supplied to local military recruiters.
Hmm. You have a quote at the end of your piece by Major Johannes Parin, head U.S. Army recruiter for Vermont and Northeastern New York. What did he say about how you can get out of it?
Well, I asked Major Parin, you know, what happens when a student or their parents tell you that they're not interested? What he told me is that he says, quote, the only thing that will get us to stop contacting the family is if they call their congressman, or maybe if the kid died, we'll take them off our list. I was a bit astonished when he said this, and I said, you know, doesn't no mean no when you hear this? And he said, look, my buddies right now are over on the front lines in Afghanistan. He said, my front lines are in the high schools of Vermont and New York. I take this seriously, and I'm going to pursue this job as aggressively as I can, and that means I'm going to keep coming after these kids because a lot of them may change their minds.
Who included, what Congress member included this provision in the No Child Left Behind Act?
There were two congressmen who were most closely associated. One was Representative David Vitter, a Republican from Louisiana. I spoke to him and asked him why he was interested in doing this, and he pointed out that in 1999, the Pentagon claimed that recruiters were denied access to over 19,000 schools. He said that these schools, quote, demonstrated an anti-military attitude that I thought was offensive. So it was the fact that any school would have the temerity, as the principal in Bennington, Vermont, did, to say that nobody gets her student information. That was offensive to him. In the Senate side, it was sponsored by Senator Tim Hutchinson from Arkansas, who was just defeated on Election Day. And both of them have basically said that...
Was there a large recruitment effort of high school students to vote in Arkansas?
Hard to say. But what's interesting is that the numbers change that the military throws around. In earlier this year, they said it was 19,000 schools hadn't participated. But then in this notice from the Department of Defense and Education that came out a couple of weeks ago explaining this new law, it says that only 1,100 schools in the country were denying the military access, or were considered, quote, problem schools. I should note that the military says it will now keep a directory of all schools that do not, in their view, comply. And schools that do not comply with this rule face a cutoff of federal aid, which essentially means they'll have to close up shop. No school can function without federal aid. And the other thing is that they will be visited by high-level military officers. If those officers don't get satisfaction, the governor of the state will be notified and asked to intervene. by the Secretaries of Defense and Education.
David Goodman, author of the piece in Mother Jones magazine, No Child Unrecruited, Should the Military Be Given the Names of Every High School Student in America? When we come back from our break, we're joined by two high school students who protested outside of their high school, Bushwick High School in Brooklyn, the recruiting by the military. We'll also be joined by a representative of the San Francisco School Board. Stay with us.
Pick up your gun, Johnny, and go to die. You've bought another chapter of the bright and shining light. Texaco Shell and Standard. Send our boys to die on foreign soil. Won't you tell me why do they have to die in Iraq? I want my freedom back.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the recruitment of high school students in the military, we're joined by two students, Andira Race, as well as Amanda Rodriguez. They are a Bushwick High School student and a Bushwick High School graduate. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Amanda Rodriguez, you graduated last year?
Yes, I did.
Any contact with the military?
Well, before I graduated, I had a recruiter from the Army come to my house. They first came to the school, and because they presented the offer and they dressed it up all nice and everything, I was intrigued by it. So they came over to my house, and they had this video planned and everything, making all these promises, saying that, well, they'll pay for your college, you know, if you serve this amount of time in the service. And you won't have to worry about, you know, reaching a level of success because they're laying it out for you. For the Air Force, they basically said, I would be going to college and working for the Air Force at the same time, which I felt was kind of hard to believe because you can't do both at the same time. I think that basically, either you're working for the military or you're studying for your own career. And that's basically my personal experience with it.
And your T-shirt, you have an American flag.
Yes, I do. The reason why, I don't know, I guess I have it because I feel America should represent what it says it represents. It represents the land of equality and opportunity. And basically, what we've been denied is other opportunities. You know, they present the military to us as our only option, our only way to succeed in life, because we come from a community where we don't do good in school, or we're infested with poverty and drugs and all of these things. I guess we should be able to have more options than the military.
We're also joined by Andira Race, a Bushwick High School student. You protested the No Child Left Behind Act in front of your school?
Actually, I don't go to Bushwick High School. I go to Bushwick Outreach.
But Bushwick Outreach?
Yeah.
You protested?
Yeah, it was in front of Bushwick High School.
Uh-huh. Why?
Well, it was actually about the fact that not everybody knew what was going on. They was just receiving the letters at home, and we didn't have, like, enough time to return the letters back to the school saying no, that we didn't want our stuff given out to the military.
I'm looking at an article in the New York Daily News, and it says students at two Brooklyn high schools told a Navy commander to shove off after he declared that most of them aren't fit to serve their country. Commander Edward Gerke Recruiting chief for the New York City region wrote in a letter published yesterday in the Daily News that most of the students at Bushwick Outreach Center and Bushwick High School can't pass a Navy qualifying exam, quote, and most have too many drug and or police issues to even be considered for enlistment, he wrote. The commander was responding to a news article about a group of students who'd protested the city's handling of a new law that gives college and military recruiters access to student addresses and phone numbers. Amanda, what's your response to that?
I mean, his statement clearly proved that we are stereotyped because of where we come from, because our community. And that alone just shows a small portion of discrimination in the military and in the system itself.
We asked a military recruiter, Patrick Sutton, Sergeant First Class, recruiter from Portland, Oregon, to join us, but somehow he's not available right now. Harold Jordan is on the line, however. He's Executive Director of the National Coalition of Education Activists. You've been working on this issue for a quarter of a century. Is recruitment up in high schools?
Well, certainly recruitment activity is up. The military has expanded its reach in schools in a variety of ways. It's not just simply a question of getting lists or getting into schools at various points. They've expanded all of their programs. They run their own testing programs in the schools. ROTC is up in high schools. There are military adopt-a-school programs. The presence has just expanded dramatically since I first started working on this issue in about 1978.
In David's piece in Mother Jones, he talks about the so-called problem schools. I used to think problem schools were where people are not, the kids aren't learning to read and write, but now they're the ones that resist the military. What about the number of schools that are allowing the Army to come in or get access to the lists?
Well, it's a very interesting situation here because the military puts out different numbers depending on who the audience is. Before Congress, they said it was 2,000 public high schools that have policies barring military recruiters and 19,000 incidents. And then when they testified before the school board in San Diego, they said that San Diego would be one of only two school districts west of the Mississippi that place restrictions on military recruiters. I guess the idea is to convince the school board that they were out of touch with reality. These things can't all be true. So, I mean, that's part of the background for it, that they will say different things depending on who they're trying to convince of what. One of the things that one of the points I'd like to make here is that in their arguments to Congress, they also point out the fact that they're in competition with college recruiters. And I think this is very interesting in light of what Ms. Rodriguez just said, that they have an opinion of a low opinion of the abilities of students. You can't have it both ways. I mean, if you want to provide students with an opportunity, it would seem to me that the school would emphasize college recruitment, recruitment for vocational training, et cetera, whereas the military takes the position that recruiters for other opportunities are too successful, thereby hurting the military. It's a very bizarre argument. But it also rests on a negative stereotype about many young people in these, quote, problem schools, ones that they consider problem schools. It's created a situation that's just a mess. I think that schools don't know how to interpret the law. The military is largely left to interpret it. The Department of Education has dropped the ball on it, for the most part, and it's a mess. I don't believe, based on what I have seen, that very many students will receive adequate notice.
We're also joined by Jill Wins, president of the San Francisco Board of Education. San Francisco and Portland, Oregon are two of the local school districts that have barred recruiters from schools on the grounds that the military discriminates against gay men and lesbians. Officials in both cities are now saying that they will grant recruiters access to the schools and to student information. Why the change?
Well, we have actually no option but to comply with the law. But remember that complying with the law means also exercising our own opportunities under the law to notify people and to do more than that, but to actually specifically focus on making sure that students are making good choices and know what choices they have to make. So some of the things you heard referenced here, I mean, we have a strong bias in our school district toward extended educational opportunities through college and university study. And so we emphasize that at every turn as much as we can. I mean, in our statements, in our the way that we present things, and the way that we have welcomed college recruiters and people who do scholarship programs, et cetera, you know, we send the message consistently that what our students ought to do is to maximize their educational opportunities. And we have, in part because of the discrimination, but also in part because of the kinds of recruiting tactics that are used by the military, some of which you've heard described here by the students you have on the program, we have restricted or barred the access of military recruiters and have, up to recently, of course, and have specifically had a policy in place against providing the information, personal information about students, because in the past the military has requested that and most schools have been providing it, even though it wasn't required by law until now.
Hmm. There was a piece in the Boston Globe yesterday that says they were among the last holdouts against military recruiting on college campuses, law schools protesting the Defense Department's ban on openly gay service members. Yet faced with the threat of losing federal funding, more than a dozen law schools have opened their doors this fall to the Pentagon's Judge Advocate General, recruiters and others in the military, handing a significant victory to the Bush administration. At Boston University, Columbia, Harvard, New York University, University of Southern California, Western New England College, Yale, and five other schools have also either changed their non-discrimination policies or taken other steps to accommodate military recruiters. And it's paying off big time. There is a far greater number of students, law students, who are now joining the military. Finally, let me ask Harold Johnson, National Jordan. Coalition, Harold Jordan, National Coalition of Education Activists, where your organizing is going to go from here.
There are young people, teachers, parents across the country who are struggling with this issue, and I think the important thing is to give accurate information, including information about the options that school boards do have. As we heard from the representative from San Francisco, it's not the case that school boards have no options. They're required to comply with the law in some way, but the law itself is not very specific. What I would suggest is that there be aggressive campaigns to notify students and parents of their options under the law, that they do have the option to opt out, and that we not depend just on the federal government or on school districts to do it, but to explain how this law came about, what it means. And that's something that I think students and parents will have to do. It's a struggle that they will have to mount.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us, and we will certainly continue to follow the story of military recruitment in the high schools. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move on to war games. Today we're going to talk about the Pentagon, which has devised numerous ways to entice young people into signing up. I'm looking now at a trailer or a preview to a video game. It's available free on a Pentagon website. It's also available through recruiting offices around the country. It's called America's Army. And it says, for the first time ever, designed by the Army, developed by the Army, created by the Army, America's Army. The official U.S. Army game, live the real Army experience. From basic training to special ops missions, authentic combat units and weapons, immersive graphics and challenges, and training or under fire, no other Army game is this real, because nobody gets the Army like the Army. More than 950,000 people have already registered online for the game. We're joined now by Jack Thompson, a father of a 10-year-old boy. He's also a Miami attorney who represents the parents of children killed in school shootings. And he says it's wrong for the military to unleash this game into a civilian population. And he's fighting the Pentagon on this, planning to file an injunction in federal court if the Army doesn't pull the plug on the game. Jack Thompson, why?
Oh, thank you. Great to be with you. Well, I'll tell you why. A number of reasons. First of all, I'm a conservative Republican. And I think conservatives, liberals, and people in the middle can agree with Clemenceau, the great French prime minister that who said that war is too important to leave to the generals. If that's true, raising children is too important to leave to them also. And what the Army's doing is doing something that the government itself said shouldn't be done by the private sector. In September of 2000, the Federal Trade Commission came out with a report in the aftermath of Columbine. It was a report, an official report ordered by President Clinton, identifying the extent to which the video game industry markets adult-rated shooter games to children, thereby increasing the risk that children will model their behavior on, copycat the very games that they're playing. That's what happened in Paducah, Kentucky, where the three girls whose parents I represent were shot and killed by Michael Carneal, who developed incredible shooting acumen playing the game Doom. We identified that game, and 8 days later, Klebold and Harris did what they did at Columbine. The problem is that teenagers tend to copycat what they put in their heads. And so here the Federal Trade Commission decried the private sector's dumping of these games into the hands of kids. The retail video game industry responded to that call, and they've stopped selling, by and large, these games to kids. What has the government done? The very government that said this was a problem, they've turned around and let the Army do what the private sector is not now doing. And this game puts kids through boot camp, which, by the way, Al-Qaeda anywhere in the world can now go through our tactical training at this website and learn what tactical skills are imparted to our soldiers. This is another problem. But the game violates every rule that the Army and our defense establishment has ever had, not to put tactical training into civilian populations outside of military control, and particularly into the hands of teenagers. And indeed, you're taught how to be a sniper and to enjoy sniping human beings, and you're allowed to scope human beings, blow their heads off. And so while the DOD was trying to find the serial snipers in the Washington area, they were training their replacements. This is absolutely nuts, and in fact, this has come in, so to speak, under the radar. Spoken with people in Congress, they don't seem to know about it, and I don't think they're to be faulted for that. I think the Army did this on its own. There's a Colonel Wardinsky who got the bright idea by watching his own kids, teenagers, playing shooter games in his home, and he said, gee, that would be cool if we taught other kids to enjoy killing people on an Army website. And so now, ostensibly, this game is being used to recruit teenage boys into the Army. When you log on to the game and also participate in their sniper chat rooms, the Army gets your email address. So now they're tracking every kid and his activities on the internet who is playing this game for heaven knows what reason. There may be something more going on here than recruiting. And indeed, unfortunately, and I say this as a lifelong Republican and defender of the right and the need of our country to defend itself through its military establishment, the Army has a very long history of conducting experiments, including the Tuskegee syphilis scandal, others including administering LSD unbeknownst to civilians and soldiers to see what their reaction to it would be. The Army has a history of conducting experiments on civilians and soldiers, so there may be a grand experiment on a very grand scale to see how teenagers respond to military training in a civilian setting and learning at the Army's behest whether or not they enjoy killing people in a virtual setting and then using that information maybe for more than recruiting. I just don't know, but we do need hearings on this to figure out why in the world the Army is doing what the government said the private sector shouldn't do.
Well, Jack Thompson, I want to thank you for being with us. Jack Thompson is a father of a 10-year-old who plans to file an injunction in federal court against the Army's video game that they're using to recruit young people. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a discussion and debate over the CIA's involvement, return to U.S. campuses. Stay with us.
Yes, I joined the Army, Air Force, Navy, too.
I learned
Zoo.
Yes, I joined the Army, Air Force, Navy, too.
A master of self-defense and karate and kung fu.
Yes, I joined the Army, Air Force, Navy, too.
Got real drunk last weekend on my tank through the zoo. The boys are getting bored now. We need some place to go. Displaying our expertise and put on a good show.
Let's not go to Cuba. I want to start a war. I want to cause a big scene in my base on Channel 4. Let's not go to Cuba. I want to start a war. I want to cause a big scene in my base on Channel 4.
You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former CIA Director Robert Gates is now the president of Texas A&M University. At Arizona State, Michael Crow became president after a stint at NQTEL, Inc., the nonprofit venture capital arm of the CIA. He had previously served as executive vice provost at Columbia University. The two appointments mark just two of the examples of how the CIA has reemerged as a major force on U.S. campuses after September 11th. At a time when American companies are cutting back on hiring and research support, the Wall Street Journal reports universities are turning to the 13 federal intelligence agencies, including the CIA, to pick up the slack. Academia, long suspicious of the CIA, has been receptive for reasons of both patriotism and self-interest. Last month, Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Golden outlined the reemergence of the CIA on campus in a frontline article entitled After September 11th, the CIA Becomes a Force on Campus. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Daniel Golden.
Thank you for having me.
You do a brief history of CIA's relationship with academia since its founding in 1947. Can you talk about who was most involved academically?
Well, in the early years when the CIA was founded and came out of the OSS, I mean, I think a lot of the Ivy League schools heavily staffed and developed its analytic side as against the operational spy side, the analytic side coming up with reports about what's going on in other countries. And since, you know, so the Ivy Leagues were sort of heavily involved from the inception, and then, you know, there was the backlash in the 60s and 70s over CIA involvement in Latin America and Chile, you know, and elsewhere. And then since then, it swung again in the 80s. I think the CIA kind of made a comeback on campuses. And then in the 90s, after the end of the Cold War, there was a lot of funding cuts at the CIA because of the feeling that we didn't face the old enemy anymore. And now since September 11th, there's been more funding for the CIA, and it's recognized that it's kind of behind, you know, technologically in spycraft and related sciences, and has been reaching out to academia both by funding research there, by looking to hire graduate students who have the scientific or linguistic expertise it needs, and so on.
You write in your piece, since September 11th, the CIA has increased its hiring goals by 85%, and it's looking to colleges to replenish its ranks. The CIA is sending intelligence officers to lecture at professional schools such as Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And the journal reports that about 30 academic, political scientists and economists are now moonlighting with the intelligence community. And over the past 2 years, the CIA's Intelligence Technology Innovation Center since has sponsored $2 million a year of unclassified research by postdoctoral fellows at Sandia National Labs, as well as 18 universities, including Harvard, Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, University of Michigan, Louisiana State. What about the issue of secrecy when it comes to CIA research and how that fits in with what's supposed to be an open discussion on campus? Who's allowed to be involved in this research and who's kept out?
Well, that's an issue of a very interesting issue and one that has a lot of tension and conflict. Traditionally, at least since the 60s and early 70s, most colleges have not allowed classified research or secret research on campus. And, of course, the CIA funds plenty of secret research, but they don't usually fund it at universities because of that proviso. Some universities have sort of off-campus sites where they do it. Now I think some universities may be considering actually conducting secret research on campus, which creates all sorts of problems because universities are traditionally committed to openness. Here you might have a situation where a faculty member couldn't tell other faculty members about his research, a student couldn't tell his professor about his dissertation, and so on. So that's becoming an issue. MIT recently said that it would not allow classified research of any kind on campus. It reaffirmed its old policy. But when I talked to Robert Gates, now at Texas A&M, he foresaw a day coming when there would be classified research at some university campuses. A related issue is who will do the research. The CIA has been increasingly asserting, as have some other government agencies, that they don't want foreign, they only want U.S. citizens doing their research, even if it's not classified or not secret. They're just concerned about foreign students, you know, being involved in the research. And universities balk at that. I think they feel if it's open research and the foreign students pay, you know, tuition just like everybody else, they shouldn't have two classes of students, essentially, one class of U.S. citizens who can do whatever unclassified research they want and a class of foreign students who can't. So those are kind of the flashpoints where the battles are taking place over whether foreign students can do research and whether there will be secret research on campus.
I remember the controversy at the Rochester Institute of Technology around the Gulf War. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, but Rochester Institute of Technology had always been kind of a favorite school of the CIA because it's up in Rochester where they do, you know, there's Xerox and there's, Polaroid or Kodak, doing imaging research. And so Rochester Institute of Technology is specialized in imaging, which is, you know, useful in satellites and in spying and so on. And so the CIA had always hired a lot of graduates of Rochester Institute of Technology. And in fact, in the 80s, it had kind of secretly funded the development of the imaging program there. And this all sort of came out in the early 90s when the president then said he was taking a leave of absence and didn't give the reason. And it turned out his leave was going to be to go work for the CIA. And in the ensuing furor, he resigned. And the school developed a bunch of policies that said that there's not going to be any sort of secret funding. We're going to disclose. We want disclosure of who funds research, who it's being done for. And the CIA stopped having, you know, its faculty members on leave teaching at Rochester Institute of Technology and sort of cut the ties. And then my story was about how sort of since September 11th, those ties have been coming back a little bit, though more openly this time. It's not a secret. I mean, they had the director of the CIA speaking at their last commencement.
George Tenet.
Yeah, George Tenet. And they're now talking about the CIA. The CIA has now suggested some research topics for senior theses by seniors at the school, and I guess they're probably working on them as we speak.
Well, we're joined by Robert Jervis now, professor of international affairs at Columbia University. You're a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Academy of the Arts and Sciences. You began consulting with the CIA during the Carter administration. Do you still do it now?
Yes, I chair what's known as the Historical Review Panel. This is a group of academics who report to Tenet advising on declassification policy and issues.
So that means
our work is classified, but our existence and who we are is unclassified, and we issue an unclassified statement after each meeting.
So you're paid by Columbia and the CIA?
Yes, I do consulting work for the CIA in this and in others, as I would consult for sometimes other either media or sometimes corporations or government agencies.
David Gibbs is also with us, professor at the University of Arizona. You wrote a piece in the LA Times called Academics and Spies, The Silence That Roars. You object to professors being on the CIA payroll. Why?
Well, I think there are two reasons. First of all, the CIA is an agency that has a rather unpleasant history. It has been involved in the dissemination of propaganda, which is something that goes fundamentally against what academics are supposed to do. It operates with an extremely high level of secrecy, again, going contrary to standard academic procedures. It has a record, basically, of overthrowing democratic governments and involvement in massive human rights violations on a systematic basis, which I think just leaving out the other considerations of secrecy and so forth, I think is would make it an agency that academics really should not work with just based upon its past record. But leaving aside its past record, there also is the problem that the CIA is basically among not only a spy agency, but a propaganda agency, and propaganda fundamentally violates basic principles of academic procedure. So based on that, I think that there should be no academic involvement with the CIA.
Professor Jervis, your response.
Well, there are lots of issues here. We have to unpack them. One is the policies that the CIA implements, like overthrowing governments. We can debate whether they were democratic or not, but anyway, overthrowing governments is a policy of the U.S. government. The argument that the CIA was a rogue elephant and acting on its own, I don't think it's believed by anyone anymore. So if we take that as the main principle, then you shouldn't consult for any part of the government. And that's a perfectly legitimate principled position. And if one is vehemently in disagreement with a lot that the U.S. government's trying to do, I can see that, because then you're, after all, if you think your advice is good and going to be taken, and it's hardly ever taken anyway, so it doesn't matter much, but if you think it is, and you really disagree with the ends that are being sought, obviously you shouldn't consult. But to draw distinctions between parts of the U.S. government, I think that's not going to work. As for propaganda, gee, last time I looked, every government, again, agency and every nonprofit that I know of engages in propaganda, and I'm not sure rigorously how we're going to separate propaganda from other forms like this news broadcast, so I think that's getting us in trouble. The secrecy issue is a different one. I don't know if you want me to talk about that or hold it. I think that's a quality.
Well, let's get Professor Gibbs' response to what you've just said.
Well, I mean, let's go from the abstract to the concrete. In terms of propaganda, the CIA has done things like publishing in cooperation with the USIA between 1947 and 1967 over 1,000 books, according to Senate investigations. They still haven't released the names of those books. We know that at least some of them have fallen into the category of what's called black propaganda, i.e., they contained information that was simply made up. An example of that was the Penkovsky Papers, which supposedly was written by a Soviet defector. It later turned out it was written by the CIA and was just essentially a phony book. This goes well beyond. It's true, every person, every agency of government, every magazine and so on has a bias, which I guess you could call propaganda, but the systematic use of black propaganda, it seems to me, is something that goes beyond the usual. And it seems to me that academics who affiliate themselves with that kind of agency risk undermining and corrupting the basic process of academia, in my view. I think that this is less of a problem. I should qualify that there are some people I know who have worked for the CIA who nevertheless have done very good work and have been academics of high integrity. And, you know, this isn't a question of pointing fingers at individuals, but as a general principle, this is an agency that engages in, for lack of a better term, systematic use of lies. That's basically what black propaganda is defined as. And I just don't see how academia can maintain its independence and have this kind of integration with a propaganda agency. As for its overthrows of governments, some of these can be very unsavory. I'll give you one example. In 1965, the CIA participated in a coup d'etat in Indonesia. We now know that U.S. Embassy and CIA officials gave lists, hit lists, to the Indonesian military of people to be assassinated. And in a fairly direct way, was complicit in assassinations. The assassinations were of sufficient scale that they totaled between 250,000 and 1,000,000 people, one of the really great mass killings of the Cold War. I'm not aware of whether academics were involved in that operation, but we do know that this operation took place. And we have to ask ourselves, do we as academics want to affiliate with an agency that has so much blood on its hands? I, for one, do not. One final point, which is that a thing that has disturbed me about academic involvement in the CIA is that the extent to which political science has whitewashed CIA activities. I did a survey of all the articles published in five of the top journals of political science that specialize in international relations. Between 1991 and 2000, the 10-year period, I found no significant discussion of covert operations by the CIA in any of them. There's kind of a celebration of U.S. foreign policy by leaving out the rather unpleasant details, such as the well-documented coup d'etat in Indonesia and many other coups like that. One really has to ask whether or not the CIA affiliations of political scientists have influenced the types of things that are published and the types of things that are not published. So based on all of these considerations, it strikes me it's a very bad idea for academia to reaffiliate itself.
That's University of Arizona Professor David Gibbs. Columbia University Professor Robert Jervis, your response.
Yeah, just three brief points. First, technically, block propaganda isn't something that's false. It's the sources disguised, and there's a significant difference, but minor. Second, again, the point of what the CIA has and hasn't done, it's in almost all cases, I believe, including the Indonesia, an instrument. And what you say may be right. It applies more broadly, singling out, say, the CIA, don't consult for that. It's implicitly okay to consult for the White House or the State Department or something. It may make some people feel better, but I think your argument would be stronger if you simply substituted the initials USG, that is U.S. government, for CIA, and that would give people, I think, a better understanding of what's happening. These are government policies. And you can also say that almost all the people who consult for the CIA consult for the analytic side, not for the operation side. They're about as separate as the CIA is from the State Department. So, I mean, I think that you really want to make more clear what the target is. Finally, I think our foreign policy experts or the academic community haven't talked about covert operations enough. Part of it is the secrecy problem. The information's highly limited. More important, I'm afraid, are things internal to the functions of the discipline. American foreign policy is not a, quote, hot area in the academic world. Much, much more abstract discussions of international systems and large quantitative studies are. There's not a lot written about American foreign policy, period. So, and the number of people who are involved in consulting who might otherwise write about covert operations is pretty small. I think the last verge is on a conspiracy.
What about the issue?
That's not the problem.
What about the issue of secret research?
That's important. It rarely comes up in social science, and I think when you talk about some of the research being done in technical areas, it is important, but it's not unique. That, I'm afraid, horses out of the barn. Every university with a decent biology department has made arrangements with, you know, the high biotech firms, and that involves very, very serious restrictions on sharing of information.
Professor Gibbs.
Well, I guess just in response to those points, I think that Professor Jervis is correct that the problem is broader than just the CIA. For example, in Indonesia, the U.S. Embassy was clearly involved in the operation as well as the CIA. The U.S. Army and the Atomic Energy Commission, for example, took the lead in experiments on humans with regard to sort of injecting people with plutonium and that kind of thing during the 50s and 60s. So certainly agencies beyond the CIA have engaged in these types of unpleasant operations that I've described. And I agree with him that any kind of consulting with U.S. government agencies is problematic. I'd say the CIA is more so, or I should say the intelligence community, broadly speaking, is more problematic.
We have 10 seconds.
The higher level of secrecy involved, that these are highly secretive agencies that go beyond, say, the State Department or the military, and I think that is one of the core problems here.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. We will continue to have discussions like these in the coming days, Professor Gibbs and Professor Jervis. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we wrap up, Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Nagara, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. If you want a video or audio copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. By the way, we're looking for an audio engineer. Video experience is helpful but not essential. Please send your resume to job@democracynow.org. Our website is www.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Pick up your gun.